Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to RightStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann. I am the founder of the RightStream Radio Network and an independent author, blogger, and social media marketer. And I'm just thrilled to welcome everyone to today's show, where my guest will be the amazingly talented author and graphic designer, Kia Heavey. You may remember last year I interviewed Kia about her fantastic thriller called Night Machines. And she mentioned at the time that she was working on a second book, not necessarily a follow-up to Night Machines, but a second book called Underlake, which is a young adult, but also a thriller. And I'm just so excited to talk to her about all of that today. I see she's on the line, and we are going to get to our interview here in just a moment. But I also wanted to just take a minute to recognize the passing of an American icon. I woke up this morning and went on Facebook and saw that my brother had posted the sad news of the passing of Shirley Temple Black. And I quickly wrote a blog post about her this morning. I was just so sad to hear the news. When I was a little kid, she was just my idol. And it's a big, long-standing joke in my family. But I wrote about it this morning at my blog, dariabgiovanni.com, and perhaps in the second half of the show I'll talk about that a little bit more. But just wanted to send out condolences to Shirley Temple Black's family and just recognize her for not just being just an incredibly talented child star, but someone who grew into a woman of character and who had such a full, incredible life and contributed so much to her country and to the world. So God bless you, Shirley Temple Black, and thank you for gracing us with your presence. You will always be remembered with love and admiration. All right, so I see that Kia is on the line. So without further ado, I'm going to bring her on because I want Kia to introduce herself to the audience. I know many of you already know her, especially if you are a member of the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance. But I actually met Kia last year on Twitter through our mutual friend Robert Bertrand, and I will forever be grateful to that, and actually just to meeting Robert, because that meeting led to me making connections with just so many talented patriots that it's just been such a blessing in my life. So I'm going to go ahead right now, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome author and graphic designer Kia Heavey to RightStream Tuesday.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Great, Kia. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's nice to hear you. What's going on?
You too. Well, I am just like so thrilled to bring you back because I know last year you were on and we discussed Night Machines, your first book, and you mentioned that Underlake was coming soon, coming in 2014, and now it's almost ready to be released. So I'm just so psyched to talk about that.
I'm very excited. I am actually this morning ordered my first proof. So of the paperback version, and I'm very much looking forward to getting that and seeing how it looks. And yeah, with a little luck, it'll be ready to release, but you seldom get it right on the very first proof, but it looked good to me digitally, so we'll see. And after that, of course, I have to do the ebook version, and once they're both up, then I will go about making more noise about it. But I don't want people to get too excited and not be able to order it just yet, you know. So,
yeah,
but within
a couple weeks. Well, sounds good. And, you know, it's that feeling is still indescribable, you know, when you first get the hard copy of your book and you're holding it in your hands, even if it still needs changes, it's
yeah,
just hard to convey that feeling you get from that.
Oh, it's great. So much fun. So it feels great to have one coming out again. It's taken me, I'm going to say, probably 3 years to come up with a concept and then write it and go through all the feedback readers and editing process and so forth. So I didn't even have a good idea for it for about a year.
The writing process, I think, you know, I don't know that there's a true understanding of what it takes to really produce a good work of fiction. I'm not saying people don't understand it, but I think if you're not someone who writes fiction, if you're not an author, and even maybe nonfiction, but, you know, it's just – I would submit, though, I think that fiction is probably more challenging because it requires so much more imagination, certainly, you know, depending on the book, there's research involved, and it's just a painstaking process. And, you know, the end result is a great book, but I think sometimes it's hard as a reader to truly understand all of the, you know, late nights and long hours and blood, sweat, and tears that goes into it.
Well, creative people understand it. You're creative, and you have a book of your own, of course. And, I mean, you understand that when you are creative, and you always have ideas. They never stop. And the real work is marshaling them into a coherent story and you know, keeping it, what's the word, keeping it coherent and working together and having a point. So, but it's a fun mental exercise. I generally write the book in my head first. Some people don't do it that way. I know they come up with a concept and start writing, and the story will tell itself, and the characters will introduce themselves. And that happens to me to an extent, but I pretty much have the book outlined in my head, including the resolution and the point that I'm trying to make. And then once I do start writing, yes, all the details come in. But it's the creative process, and, you know, it happens. I mean, you can't make it not happen, you know. So it's very good to have an outlet, and writing's a great outlet.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Key, I just have to say, when you said have a point, you just reminded me of that movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Steve Martin and Gun Candy.
Yeah. Why?
Because there's that scene where he says to him, Steve Martin's character says, you know, when you tell these stories, have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
Yeah. I think Saturday Night Live did a skit about that a while back, too, or somebody just never told real stories. They would think they were telling a story, and it would just kind of be a scenario. And the person they were talking to got so mad after a while. They're like, a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, because the person didn't ever have any point. So it was kind of funny.
So we can paraphrase that to say, have a point because it makes it so much more interesting for the reader.
Oh, sure. Or how about reading a whole book and then you get to the end and it had no point and you'll never get that time back, you know?
Yeah. Well, Kia, I want to back up for a minute, though, and just for anybody listening that may not know you, I just want to give you an opportunity to kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey as a writer.
Okay. Again, probably like most of the people that you and I know, I've always written for fun since I was a kid. My mother was always writing, so I always saw her doing that, and it just became something natural that I did. And so I did not study it particularly in school. I have a degree in literature. I think I was a German literature major, however, which I don't really use for much now. German literature is very odd. And from there, I went into the advertising industry professionally. I am an art director, graphic designer. That's what I do for a living. I do have a day job. And I had a creative outlet. I used to have a couple of bands that I was in. I'd play guitar, and I wrote songs, and would sing and have a great time doing that. Obviously, once you have kids, you can't really stay up late anymore, so that kind of fell by the wayside. And when my kids were little, I needed a creative outlet again, and it was harder for me to get out of the house. My husband would work a lot of evenings, so when they would go to bed at night, I would have about an hour before I would pass out, and I started writing again. I had this story in my head that had been there for probably 5 years kicking around, and that became Night Machines, my first novel. So that is how I got into the writing again, and again, it was a wonderful mental exercise. My day job was not very creative at that time, so I needed the creative outlet as well, and it served a lot of purposes for me. And as I wrote, I learned more and more online. I learned from friends. I made friends like you and Robert and other people that we know. And I don't know, that's how I got into it, and now I love it, and I don't see how you stop once you're into it. So that is how it happened.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, and just for anyone who hasn't read Night Machines, I mean, it is just a page-turner. And Kia, I mean, it's such a unique concept. I never read anything like that before in my life.
Well,
and
that's indie, so we all love them.
Say that again. I interrupted you. I didn't mean to.
I always talked over you. I'm sorry, but I said that's indies. That's why we love them. We read independent authors so much because they're all unique. That's why they're independent. If they don't fit into a slot in the industry, they're not going to get an agent and get printed. So the independent book market is the place to go for fresh ideas. I love it.
Yeah, definitely. And that reminds me, I mean, and since you brought that up, I mean, it's just amazing what new technology and social media has done for independent authors.
Oh, yeah.
So
very much so.
It's a great time to be a writer and a reader, because as a reader now you have so many more choices than before.
Oh yes. Oh, I love it. Again, absolutely. And one thing that you were talking earlier about what it takes to write a book, and there are many independent authors out there now. There's millions of them. I mean, it's very difficult to pick a book, you know. But one of the things that it does take is patience, because once you write your book, as you know, then you take a long time honing it and getting it right before you release it. And I remember when I first finished the first draft of my first book, you have that feeling like, okay, my book's done. I'm just going to send it around, and it's going to be huge now. And it isn't at all. It's really not ready, usually. You need to show it to some other people and get some opinions, because you can't see everything yourself. Other people can point things out that do need to be tweaked or whatever. So that is one of the things I recommend, is patience to get your book as good as you can.
Absolutely, because there's still so much more pressure, I think, on independent authors to be the very best you can be and to make sure that all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted.
Oh.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, you could read a paragraph and there could be like, you know, two or three typos. And if you're the author, sometimes you literally can't see them because you know what you mean to say.
Exactly. Exactly right. You should work with an editor if you can. And also, independent authors, we don't have a staff like a traditionally published author has, or they go through a publishing agency that has, you know, editors and people working and proofreaders and so forth. So in theory, the author gets to be a lot more creative and has somebody else do the nuts and bolts work. But independent authors are, of course, one-man shows. We have to think of ourselves as entrepreneurs, and that means we have to handle all the facets of our business, and that includes perfecting the product. So, yes, patience and hard work.
Yes, and, you know, and I found, too, you know, speaking of social media, and you and I are part of an amazing group of writers,
oh, yes,
that you have people, you know, you can connect with people who really will take the time. And it's so important to return the favor. I should stress that as well. But there are people who are willing. I just went through this with the synopsis I'm writing for someone else. But, you know, that are willing to take the time and read and give constructive feedback. And that's just such an amazing gift that we have now, too.
Oh, I know. I love that. The writer community is great online, and we are very supportive of one another, and we'll mentor one another. I just love to see a new writer come out with their draft and refine it and get it where they want it and put it out there. I love that, and I'll support them doing that. It's wonderful. Anyone can do it now. Like you said, the technology is amazing. It's really a wonderful time in a lot of ways.
Now, Kia, you know, I just, speaking of Robert, you know, he recently created a fantastic book trailer for Night Machines.
He did,
I just want to, you know, just want to give him a shout out and just maybe, you know, ask you. Obviously, you know, book trailers are, I mean, the fact that you had one made obviously shows that you think they're important. So, how do you? I mean, let's talk a little bit about marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's important for authors to have book trailers for all their books and be out on social media using Twitter and Facebook? And what are the things that you do to promote your work?
Social media is one of those things that, to me, has become so very vast that I don't feel like I can handle all of it myself. So that's why I was very grateful that Robert had his company, Alanza Tree, starting up, because there are things that I don't know. I don't know exactly where you would even put your book trailer, but Robert knows all these sites where people go to look at book trailers so they can figure out what they want to read. There's Twitter, there's Tumblr, there's, I don't even know, I can't even start. You know, there's Facebook, there's so many places, there's new ones all the time, there's new technologies to learn all the time. It's daunting, you know, so if you can get some help, good. What do I do personally? I personally really enjoy Twitter, and I keep following people because I think so many people are interesting and cool, and then, of course, you wind up following, you know, a couple thousand people, and it's hard to keep up with everyone in that feed, and you can't realistically, of course, but I really do love little links and quick clicks and things that you can get through Twitter. A lot of people swear by Facebook. I'm afraid that I don't really have a good author page right now. I have my own website where people can go. It's just sort of a clearinghouse for information. I think that's pretty much mostly what I do. I am not an expert in what you should be doing. I think it also depends on your genre. My new book that's coming out is YA, and I frankly don't really know where a lot of the young people hang out online. I started sniffing around a couple sites that my kids go on, and then I felt like a weirdo because I'm in my 40s and there are mostly kids on the sites, you know, so I was like, I better not. So to be honest with you, I have not started marketing the new book yet, and I assume I will learn a lot about YA marketing as I go along there. I kind of have an evil plan to market it in that I will go through people my age who have children who are in their teens and go through them to recommend it to their children. I also know that I personally like to read a lot of YA books. A lot of women do, especially. If they have daughters, they'll read their daughter's books. My daughter recommends her YA books to me a lot, and some of them are very good. I mean, we've talked about this in our group, I know, Hunger Games and things like that. Well, I think the moms are a good door to the teen readers, so I will let you know if that works.
Well, to me, that just sounds smart. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Wrote the new book with the moms in mind as well, so it should be a story that appeals to both moms of daughters and, of course, teen girls.
So what made you decide to write a YA thriller? I mean, was it the fact that you have a daughter and you have kids that are interested in that? I mean, what prompted you to want to take a stab at that genre?
I don't really know. It's a combination of things, I guess. After my first book, I was casting around for an idea. I even started writing a sequel to the first book, but it just wasn't grabbing me. And then this story came into my head a lot, and it also addresses some social issues. When I was a teenager, I remember all the kids around me, the things that they liked, the music they listened to, and so forth. It didn't appeal to me, really, and I felt, I don't know, a lot of kids would call me a prude or whatever. I felt like I couldn't relate to it, but that everyone was pushing everyone so hard in this one direction, and I didn't care for it. But you didn't really have a lot of alternatives, so it kind of made me want to write this book as an alternative for teen girls, especially who, I don't know what the right word for it is, who want to live a certain modest sort of lifestyle and are not impressed with, you know, the Katy Perrys and the Lady Gagas and the Miley Cyruses and so forth. But they don't have a lot of support. The culture pushes them in a bad direction, and unfortunately a lot of parents I know also have a very lackadaisical attitude about raising their children these days. They have this attitude that the kids are going to do it anyway, so, you know, I just want to make sure they do it safely, whether it's sex or drugs or whatever it is. You know, I'd rather they did it in our own house. And I think that's horrible. I think that a kid, a lot of the time, especially a kid who's kind of turned off by the culture, could really use a parent telling them, no, I don't want you to behave that way. But a lot of kids don't have that backup at home anymore, and I think that's really sad. So that's what this book looks at.
That's excellent, Kia. I know, and it is. It's such a tragic commentary on our times. I mean, I can totally relate to what you're saying because I was the same way as a kid. And, you know, I thank God every day that I had a traditional upbringing with, you know, in a loving, stable home and parents who really took the time to discipline because even at that age, I appreciated the fact that, like, that there were boundaries, that my mother cared about what I had for homework that night, what I was doing in school, what was affecting me emotionally and personally. You know, there was genuine interest. I find today, and I'm not a parent, so I have to, you know, full disclosure, but just from what I've observed, I feel like we're living in this culture of self-absorption, especially if the parents are divorced or whatever the situation is. Where all they really care about is their own social life, and they just really don't care about the emotional needs of the kids. I mean, they might be taking care of them materially, but that's not everything.
Right, but they treat them like little grown-ups. And they can make their own decisions. They know what they're doing. No, they can't. They want you to tell them not to do that. You know, but parents don't anymore. And as a mom now, too, I'm happy to be able to come in on the other side of this because when I look back at my teenage years, my parents were divorced, so like you were saying, it was hard for them sometimes to pay attention to every aspect of what we were up to, and I wanted them to, and so in retrospect, now I'm on the parent side of it, and I see the pressures that parents are under, especially depending on where you work. I spent the majority of my career in the fashion industry. Boy, do you have to be hip and cool and edgy to be in that industry, and you can't be judgmental about anything ever, you know? And a lot of the ads that we would work on, you know, I would think they were very tacky or in poor taste. But, sex sells, that's what you always hear in the marketing meetings. And I would speak up sometimes, I would say there is also a number of potential clients whose sex turns them away. You know, you're repelling a lot of people with this. Oh, no, no, no. So that's prevalent in a lot of the culture. Look at the horrible movies and musical acts that we have nowadays, you know. And so I just think that the parents are under a lot of pressure, too, to be a certain way, to be hip and cool and non-judgmental. And you don't, you know, a lot of parents, I think, are afraid of turning their kids away from them by being too uptight and controlling. And I don't think that's the case. I know I don't mind it at all. I liked it when I was a kid. I do it for my children. I have a wonderful husband who's a great partner in this, and our kids know that certain behaviors are expected of them, and I think that they're glad for the boundaries. They see their friends struggling with all these things, like a lot of kids in the elementary schools, fourth and fifth grade, you're supposed to start worrying about having a boyfriend or a girlfriend and when you're going to start kissing and stuff. And it's like, you know what, just be kids.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh, you know, yeah, and just... I mean, just looking around at what's going on, I mean, again, I'm so grateful that, you know, that it sounds like, you did too. We were given the gift of childhood innocence. I mean, I didn't know about,
yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, maybe I was the opposite extreme. I mean, there was stuff I didn't even know about till I was in college. I mean, certain things. But,
right.
You know, I just...
I'm sorry? Daria? I seem to have lost the connection.
Key, are you still? I am so sorry. Blog Talk
Radio
just disconnected me. Oh my goodness.
Oh, okay. I thought it was me. I was about to hang up and call you back. Uh-oh.
No, please. Whatever happens, just stay on the line, and I don't know. That was really bizarre. Very strange. But hey, what is internet radio if not fraught with technical challenges? But I was just saying that it's just. I mean, I believe this is all by design. I mean, this hypersexualization of children. I mean, the sexualization of children. And I've always, you know, the older I get, the more grateful I am that I was allowed to have childhood innocence. And it sounds like you did, too.
Yeah. I'm very grateful for it. And I, as a child, also looking back, I see that I sought to protect it for myself as well. I didn't want to do the stuff that all the other kids were rushing to do. It wasn't for me. I just didn't feel ready for that. And I don't think kids are ready for it emotionally.
No, they're not. You know, it's funny. I remember an episode, this is crazy, but I remember an episode of The Golden Girls, which unfortunately had a very left-wing bias, but there was an episode one time when their 16-year-old girl that they knew had gotten pregnant, and I think it was Dorothy, one of the characters, said something like, you know, just because the plumbing is in doesn't mean that the house is ready to occupy, and I just always thought that was so funny but so true, because you brought up emotion. I mean, yeah, I absolutely reject, I mean, in fact, I'm horrified by this concept that, well, they're going to do it anyway. No, that's not necessarily true. I mean, that's like saying that human beings have no control over their impulses.
Oh,
you know,
I know,
so
we're alley cats.
And,
yeah. We're like dogs. Or, you know, you can't help it, you gotta go do it. I like to think people are a little more developed than that, human beings are.
Yeah, I mean, there is such a thing as delayed gratification, and there's a good reason to practice that when it's appropriate.
I agree. And I also, as you were saying earlier before we got cut off, too, you brought up a good point, which is that childhood innocence is not respected anymore, and that disturbs me a great deal. It's one thing I really resent about progressivism especially, is that there is no respect for childhood. I mean, it's never too early to start teaching the kids these things that they think are great, and I don't think that's a fair thing to do to a child. You know, they're still developing their sense of right and wrong and morality and self. And it's kind of sick to start twisting that up so young. So I like to let them be children myself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, let them go outside and play. And they should be learning the basics. They should, you know, when you're in first grade, you should be learning how to add and subtract, how to read, how to spell.
Yeah, remember that?
But again, if you know, and you know what I find really ironic, Key? I want to get your take on this, too. I mean, we're in this culture that's obsessed with sex, and yet people that have large families are derided, like, and ridiculed. Like, okay, now I know the Duggars, that's an extreme example. Okay, they have 19 kids or whatever. But the fact remains is it's their choice. They take care of their own kids. They're not on government assistance. They want to have a big family. But even people, I mean, I'm the youngest of five, okay? And even back then, people would say to my mother, oh, my God, you have five kids. Like, you know, we're obsessed with sex in this culture, and yet something that's a natural outcome of sex is completely mocked. I mean, it makes no sense to me at all.
There's long been an effort to separate sex from reproduction, and there's long been an effort to separate marriage from child rearing. But as you say, yes, there is a natural procession that is supposed to occur, and there's like this myth going around that you can have one without the others. Especially there's a delusion that if you just take, you know, free government birth control, there will never be an unwanted baby. And that's ridiculous. We all know that. But people don't know that. They think that if they do take this free government birth control, they'll never have an unplanned pregnancy. And there is no birth control that is 100% effective. Even when you use it correctly all of the time, it still will fail between 1% and 3% of the time. So,
yeah,
you know, for every 100 times someone does it, they have a 2% chance of coming up pregnant, even with their birth control. So it's kind of a trap in a lot of ways that women, you know, are told, oh, you should be out there having empowering sex and so forth, and you're perfectly safe, but then you're not, of course, and then they turn up pregnant, and then they have a horrible choice, you know? Do you become a single parent and thereby increase your chance of living independence and poverty, or do you abort your child and thereby spend your life regretting what you've done, you know? It's a horrible choice to have. Best would be to avoid it altogether, but no one's ever really presented with that as an option, and they should be.
Right, you know, and that's another bill of gold, what am I trying to say?
Bill of goods
that's been sold erroneously to women. This concept that liberation equals being treated like a piece of meat, like liberation equals having millions of sex partners. How is it liberating to be treated like a piece of meat? Somebody explain.
I sometimes think that is the funniest hoax that has ever been pulled over on feminists, is that they have been convinced that to truly realize their feminine power, they need to basically let men use them like a toilet. I mean, that makes you a powerful woman somehow. And if the man knocks them up, well, then he can just get them an abortion. So the men have no responsibility. And the women get to be treated like pieces of meat and think that it's good for them, and they'll fight for it. And it cracks me up. It's like, really, suckers? You know?
No, it's true. And, I mean, I often think, you know, Susan B. Anthony must be spinning in her grave because she
was all about empowerment
in the sense of getting men to live up to their responsibilities to their woman and their family. Not, and she was pro-life. I mean, people seem to conveniently forget that about her.
Yeah. I'm sure this is not what she intended.
I want to let everybody, let me just take a cut in here and take a moment to remind everyone, if you have a question for Kia, you can call into the show at 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. And please call in. I mean, we love to get questions. Kia, I want to ask you, so we're talking about all of these themes. How do you actually incorporate them into your works of fiction so that they're there, but maybe they're subtle, and they're still wrapped up in an entertaining package? I mean, how does that play out in your book?
Well, the number one thing I do is tell a story. I never write a book with the idea of I need to get this point across. I want everyone to understand this message. I would never write a fiction story like that because it's going to basically be a lecture. And, I mean, that's pretty much what most movies are these days. You know, that's why nobody goes to them anymore. No one wants to be lectured at. I want to be entertained. So I'm not going to write a book unless I have an intriguing, entertaining story in mind. And then I just write the story. And, you know, just being who we are, the stories are going to come out a certain way from a certain point of view. Was it C.S. Lewis? I can't remember, who said we don't need more conservative fiction. We need more conservative fiction writers or something like that. I've totally mangled it. But, you know, the point is that don't write a conservative story. Just be a conservative person, be a creative person, and the story will tell itself, and it will contain the messages within it just by the way it's told and what happens. So that's how I feel about that.
Yeah, oh, me too. Absolutely. Yeah. It just comes out because of who you are and your values, you know, as
right.
a writer. But your first goal should be to entertain and to write a strong, you know, well-constructed story.
Right, and I mean, like, for instance, my first book, again, Night Machines, was about, a woman who was pursuing her career, even though she had these small kids at home and a wonderful husband, you've read the story, I don't want to go into it too much, but there were, she thought she should be living this kind of life where she should be chasing this career and these lofty goals and this desirable man and so forth, and it didn't work out. Obviously, it wasn't a good idea. It wasn't right for her and her family. And I spent about a year trying to get an agent, a literary agent, and I queried so many people, and none of them liked it. And the reason is because all of these women were women who basically were single because they'd given their lives to their career. They all live in Brooklyn. They all ride the subway into the city and read their manuscripts on the train. They don't have kids. They don't have marital issues. So they couldn't relate to it. It didn't mean it's a bad story, and it doesn't mean they pick bad stories, but it's not their story. So sometimes the conservative writers and the libertarian writers, we do not get agents, we do not get traditionally published because it's just what comes out. It's a conservative or traditionalist or libertarian message, and the traditional publishers just can't relate to it. It's not their lifestyle. So that's fine, but that's why we go around them now and be indie published.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's kind of like, I think that, how do I want to say this? I mean, traditional publishers and even just pop culture in general, they're trying to push a narrative. They're not so much, they say that they're reflecting reality, but the fact is they're actually pushing their version of reality
onto
the culture.
Yeah.
No,
you're absolutely right about that. And it's intentional on some people's part. It's unintentional on others. But you're absolutely right. That is the result.
Because, Kia, when you look around, every once in a while a movie will come along, let's say, for example, that upholds traditional values. Like, I remember several years ago, A Night with the King. It was about Queen Esther from the Bible. I mean, that thing, it was an independent film, and it was wildly successful. And, I don't know, I'm sure you could mention other movies, but it's like every once in a while they come along with one that really appeals to a large audience and, quote-unquote, sells, and yet these movies are still few and far between. So if it was just all about the money, we'd be seeing more movies that celebrate
it. It isn't all about the money. And people just cannot see the vision, the leftist, traditionalist entertainment industry, they cannot see that vision. It doesn't make any sense to them. So part of it is not just the money. It's like they just don't get it, But I do think that the money is starting to speak up. There are a couple of sort of epic biblical movies coming out this year. I think that's kind of interesting. So I think we have Noah coming out. I just saw a trailer for a movie called Son of God. And these are very obviously back to basic conservative-themed movies, going pretty much back to biblical tale. So, again, they maybe there isn't the vision there of what a conservative or traditionalist or libertarian story would look like, a contemporary story, but at least there's a recognition that there is some money to be made there. So we'll see how these films do, and perhaps the industry might say, okay, these work well. I guess there is a big traditional audience. Who can give me a script of a contemporary story that they might like? So I'm crossing my fingers. Hopefully it's changing a little bit in the traditional entertainment industry. And then you also have the independent entertainment industry. You just mentioned an independent film you saw. There seem to be more and more studios popping up, too. And obviously it takes time to get up to speed, to get funding, to get distribution in place. A lot of these movies are very hard to see. When they do come out, they're not going to be in your local movie theater. But that's changing, and I'm glad to see it.
Right, and a recent one that's done very well is Lone Survivor. Actually, that's one that I can think of right now based on Marcus Luttrell's account.
When was the last time they made a good war movie? You're absolutely right. Every single one of them has been about how awful and corrupt the war is, You're right.
Yeah, and very derisive of military members. Predators that just want to kill people, or they are these poor, backwoods hicks who didn't have anything better to do than join the military. That's how they're presented in the movies.
No, you're right. So we have not had a good heroic war movie in quite some time, and it was interesting. My husband and some of his friends actually went out to go see that. A bunch of other veterans and retired military, they all went to go see it. And I've been married quite some time now, probably 15 years. 17 years, I don't remember my husband once saying, I'm going to go see that movie. So that was remarkable.
Yeah, amazing. So, Kia, tell us a little bit about Underlake. I mean, I don't want you to give away the whole story, but share with us.
Well, it's like I said, I'm still just getting it up, so I'm not good at talking about it yet. I don't have my, my elevator, whatever
elevator
it's called,
seat.
Put together yet. But it is, as we said before, a YA book. It's not as much of a thriller as Night Machines was. It's a love story, and it does have, like Night Machines, it's realistic. It reads like realistic fiction. and yet there are also a few elements of the supernatural in it. But they don't show up right away in the beginning. That's kind of the way I write my books. Some people have even said my books start off a little slow. I don't know about that. It's just I'd like to get people involved in an ordinary day-to-day world and then introduce some extraordinary circumstances. So this book is about a girl named Katie Welch, who's 15, and she lives with her mother in Manhattan, and her mother is an editor at Get With It magazine, which is one of the happening women's magazines. And for a couple of personal reasons, her mother makes Katie go upstate for the summer to upstate New York, rather than go to all the exotic destinations that she usually goes to. All of her wealthy friends always go to all these places all around the world. So Katie's kind of resentful and angry, and she's afraid to spend the summer in this, like, little tiny farm town up in the mountains. She's actually even a little frightened because she's never been anywhere so, I don't want to say uncivilized, but that she doesn't understand. I mean, she's been all around the world. She's been to jungles and so forth with tour guides, and but she's just concerned because she doesn't never met any people like these people. And when she gets to the town of Under Lake, which is on the shore of this lake called Under Lake, she meets a lot of the local kids, and they actually turn out to be pretty neat. And she develops friendships with them.
Key, are you still there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I don't know if we're having technical problems. If I'm got booted out again, I can't hear her anymore.
I'm here. Can you hear me? I'm still here. Hello?
Hi, Kia. Blog Talk Radio again. Kicked me
Yay.
Out. So, I'm sorry. So, please repeat everything you just said.
Okay, well, just that this 15-year-old girl who lives in the city with her fashionable mother, and they wind up spending the summer upstate New York in a very small town on the edge of a lake, and she's very apprehensive about going there. She's always traveled the world to exotic locations and very civilized, sophisticated settings, and this is the first time she's ever, like, been so close to the land particularly, but when she meets the people there, she gets along with them very well, it turns out. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes.
Okay, great.
So interesting. And, so it's kind of like culture shock for her a little bit, though, because she's
correct.
Used to being sort of this child of privilege.
Correct.
And,
right.
And
she's
now
always,
she's kind of...
And it's not just that. Also, that when you are raised that way, there is a certain element of prejudice against people who live simpler lives out in the country. Like, oh, well, they're not going to be very civilized, they're not going to be very smart, they aren't going to be safe, they're going to be, like, crazy or something. So she's pleasantly surprised by that. She also is an artist herself and just falls in love with a beautiful setting, and she goes and sits on the shore of the lake every day and sees this weird boy swimming out in the middle of the lake sometimes. Eventually she winds up meeting him, and he's very odd, but they click immediately. And so that she's very happy to make his acquaintance. They become good friends. Her mother eventually finds out about this, and because he works at a farm nearby and does not go to college or anything, her mother is not happy with it. And he's also very strange, but Katie is just so very happy to have met someone that understands her that she ignores a lot of warning signs. And I'm not going to tell you anymore.
Well, it sounds great. I can't wait to read it. I really can't.
Well,
so you're thinking that your estimated release date is a couple weeks? Or,
yeah, I would think the paperback's probably going to be available in about a week or two. I'll be sure to send you one as soon as it is. And then I would hopefully have the e-book up by the end of the month. So that's the plan.
Oh, I'm so excited. I can't wait.
Good. I hope you like it.
Now, Kia, in addition to being a fantastic writer and storyteller, you mentioned that you're also a graphic designer, and I just, here's my chance to give you a shout out, because Kia she created the logo for of the book that I'm ghostwriting for a client right now, and we're in the process of finalizing the cover, and just, you know, it's been a really great experience working with you, and I know this is a kind of an intense concept that we're working on here, and
I don't know how you were writing that. My gosh, that is a lot to get your brain around. Many, many concepts in that book.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you, it's amazing that you just sort of hit the nail. I mean, with the first cover attempt, I mean, we're so close. We just have a few little tweaks, and, you know, my client was just absolutely thrilled with it. I mean, he loves your work.
I'm so glad. Well, you know what? Again, my whole life and my whole career, I've been in the Northeast here in advertising and in fashion advertising, and as we were saying, philosophically and culturally, I'm kind of at odds with a lot of the people I've always worked with. But it's just kind of a real pleasure to work with you and other people who I'm on the same wavelength with. And it does seem that as far as my design work goes, I get it more quickly. And I think we're all on the same page more so that it just the design work comes out more to everyone's liking pretty quickly. So it's kind of a pleasure.
Yeah, and it's great, and, you know, and that's another, you know, let me just give another shout-out, too, to the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook, because, you know, we mentioned Robert, he's another resource, and Jamie
he's
Wilson,
fantastic.
Who's creating Liberty Island Media. I believe she posted something in there the other day about how she's going to have a page on the site dedicated to people that provide services, relate, you know, for writers like you, with the graphic
mm-hmm.
design and the book, and Robert with the book trailers. And, I mean, I think
yeah,
that's so important that we support each other. Like
I do too, because we can get behind each other wholeheartedly, and that is a joy, especially when you're a creative like I am and you write copy or create design for people's product. If you can actually believe in the product, it's so much easier. I guess it's probably similar to acting. I wouldn't know because I've never been able to act, but I have to create a desire for a product through my work, and if it's a product that I don't desire, it's really hard for me to do, you know, but it's just... It's so much easier with the things that people are writing and creating in our group.
Yeah, you know, and I can relate to that from the ghostwriting end, because this is the second book now that I've ghostwritten for somebody. The previous one was Reflections on the Ring, which was a memoir, which was much more relatable because the client actually happened to be a friend of mine who, you know, turned an unexpected pregnancy and sort of like shotgun courthouse wedding into this beautiful
narrative. And it was a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. And, I mean, that's something that you can totally relate to and get behind. I can't imagine how you could possibly write a novel-length book that you couldn't get into the concept. How is that book doing? I keep meaning to ask you. How is Reflections on the Ring doing?
It's coming along. Actually, Lori just had an interview on the Terry O'Brien Show Sunday night.
Oh.
And, you know, she's sort of, because of the nature of the subject matter, she's kind of she's a little reticent about marketing it too much, so I've kind of had to cool my jets sort of respect her for that.
Right.
But, you know, and I understand where she's coming from. I mean, it took a lot. I mean, I will say this, and I don't want to make, you're my guest, and I don't want to make this all about.
No, I'm asking.
I just want to say this, you know, the process of writing that, ghostwriting that was several years, and not because the book was hard to write, but because Lori actually, somewhere midway through the project, thought, you know, I can't do this, I can't put this out there, and so
yeah.
She said, and I said, Lori, you know, I totally understand, I've got it, I'm not doing anything with it, you know, just let me know if and when you're ready to move forward with it, and so last June, she contacted me, and this was after, I think, at least a year, and she said, you know, I just had this experience, and it was, I've been praying for a sign, and this was what I needed, and what had happened was her older daughter, she has two daughters now, but, you know, her older one, you know, when she was saying her prayers one night, you know, Lori, you know, they have their ritual where they say their prayers and together,
mm-hmm.
and she said the first thing out of her mouth was, thank you, God, for my life. And Lori was immediately transported to that day in the doctor's office where, you know, she didn't know Gianna, her daughter's father, very long when this happened. And
right.
She said, it just kind of brought me back to that moment. And she said, I just started crying, and I realized that, you know, I had to get the story out there. So, you know, that's how that played out. Now, with the second one that I'm ghostwriting, and here's my point, because getting back to what you were saying,
mm-hmm.
I cannot ghostwrite a book unless I can actually buy in to...
Exactly.
The concept, and also I have to have some measure of respect for the author and what they're trying to accomplish, and I have to actually like them as a person. I'm not saying we have to be best friends, but if I don't respect them or what they're trying to do, it just doesn't work for me.
Oh, I can't imagine how you would be able to, no. I can create sales materials for things that I don't necessarily think are great, but I think that just the personal and intellectual process of writing a book would be impossible if you couldn't support the material.
And in fact, I mean, I've had projects that I've turned down. I mean, I had one that would have paid me a lot of money, and it was just – and I don't want to go into detail.
Yeah, okay, of course not.
On a public forum, but I just,
it wasn't for
you.
You
know, I thought about it and thought about it, and I just said, you know what, I'm not going to – you know, I come from a family where – I didn't want to dishonor my family by getting involved. It had to do with the mafia and things that that my family was so far removed from growing up. And I just thought, you know, and then I kind of thought, you know, if it gets out that I'm the ghostwriter,
yeah,
I could be putting myself in some danger here, and it's just not it just wasn't worth it to me. So
No. Well, I perpetuate that stereotype too.
Right. I mean, my dad came from immigrants and worked hard to become a doctor. My grandfather on my mom's side came here when he was 8 and became a pharmacist, very well respected. And I just thought, you know, everyone in my family is an upstanding citizen. I thought, I'm not getting involved with this slime and dragging my reputation down. So, you know,
the point is, you
do have to have the buy-in, though. It's so true.
Yeah. And just as a designer, like I said, I am so happy to know this community and to help out, paid or mentoring or giving advice. I love it. It feels good for my brain. It's a mm-hmm. delightful thing.
You know, and one of the other things that I love about this group, too, is that, and I think I talked about this last week, but that we're able to maybe disagree on certain topics or have a different opinion about something and still like each other at the end of the comment thread.
Right. No, we have to, and respect each other, and it is a wonderful group, the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, and it was started up by Masha, I'm not sure how she pronounces it. I'm an internet friend of hers, but she had a small government book fan club on Goodreads, and I met her through that, and she and I wound up starting the CLFA on Facebook, and the whole point was that conservatives and libertarians have all of these opinions that in some ways seem very opposite. We have, like, conservative Christians, and we have gay people. We have people who want all drugs to be legal. We have everything. But we all have something in common, which is that we want the government out of our business. And I think this group is very important. That's why we call it an alliance. We all need to get past our little social personal issues, respect each other's social personal issues, and just vote consistently to get the government out of our business. And if we can do that, they can't touch us, and it would be great. So that was the goal. And, of course, it's the Fiction Alliance because all of us are avid readers. A lot of us are writers or editors or reviewers or publishers, and we're all involved in fiction in one way or another. So we all understand that the message that comes out in society through entertainment tends to steer society in certain directions. And so we all want to help affect a change to get our message out through fiction and entertainment.
Yeah, because culture drives politics. I mean, there's just no question about it. And I think really with all of us in that group, it's really a respect for the Constitution. And I think, you know, so many of our problems could be easily solved if we just followed the Constitution. And, of course, we're so far gone from that right now that it's probably going to take 50 years to get back to basics. But we need to at least start the process.
Right, we have to start the process, exactly. And we have to remember to respect each other and work together. And unfortunately, social issues have been very effectively used as a wedge to divide us up. And so that is one thing we're hoping to overcome with this group, is like, you know what, we have different social opinions, whatever. We should all be free to have our social opinions. Free, oh yes, freedom. That's the one thing we all agree on. So let's promote that.
Yes. And, you know, and I pointed out recently, and I think we had a thread because, you know, we had the anniversary, the unfortunate anniversary of Roe versus Wade a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
And I just find it, talk about irony. We talked about the irony of our sex-obsessed culture. There's also the irony of, you know, the left saying, oh, government, out of the bedroom, out of the bedroom. And I always say,
I know.
You know what? The government is already in the bedroom because, one, Roe versus Wade is unconstitutional. No one got to vote on it.
Right.
And two, they're forcing taxpayers to pay for it. You know,
I think that's unconscionable. It just, you know what? Half the people in this country think that abortion is murder of a baby, and you're forcing them to pay for it. I think that's sick. Yeah, if it's going to be legal, it's legal, fine. But to force people to subsidize what they consider infanticide, I just think that's unconscionable. And I've, to be honest with you, I've in my youth, I've been on both sides of that issue. I have all these different opinions about it. Back in the day, I used to send donations to Planned Parenthood. I believe they were providing clinical services for poor women, and they were. But even then, even when I was a supporter of theirs, I never believed in spending taxpayer money on something that is unconscionable to at least half the country. How can they do that? I do not understand that.
You know, and the irony, too, now, Kia, with ultrasound technology and science,
science.
That shifted public opinion in favor of the unborn. I mean, my point is you don't have to be religious to see that this is wrong. You know?
Correct. It's funny how that's happened, you know.
Yeah, which is why... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, it looks like those crazy religious people had a point after all, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, really, and that's also the reason why, you know, the left, who claims to want women to be informed, you know, before they make their choices, well, why do they fight so hard against them seeing ultrasounds? You know, don't you want that woman to be able to make an informed choice? And, you know, and Lori, you know, I listened to Lori's interview. We mentioned her on the Terry O'Brien show the other night, and she made a very interesting point. She said, why isn't adoption promoted in our culture? It's, you don't really see much about it anywhere. And, and I want, because Key, I want to get your opinion on this. You know, and she also made the point, and this is so true, is that people are actually afraid to adopt when they can because the court system is so screwed up that if you adopt a child 3 years later, you know, there's a real possibility that the natural parents can say, oh, guess what, we want that baby after all, and you can have that child taken away from you.
I don't, well, I don't really know anything about this, so I really can't comment much, but I don't think that can happen very often. I think that's unusual.
It has, though. No, it has happened.
It has happened, but there's usually unusual circumstances. Well, maybe that explains why so many people adopt internationally. So that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, and that's another irony. You know, they're, you know, we're how many are we up to now? 55 million since Roe murdered, and people have to go outside of the country and pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to adopt a baby. It's just insane.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are insane right now. You're right.
But I'm sorry, I'm getting off on my soapbox.
No, absolutely.
So,
and your friend Lori is very brave, and I'm sorry. I mean, I understand when you explained that she's reticent about telling her story, but, I mean, just from where I'm standing, I wish she would tell her story because, like you were just saying, no one talks about adoption. No one also talks about doing what she did, which is doing the right thing. You know, it's like, oh, shotgun wedding, that's so archaic, whatever. No one does that anymore. Well, in fact, they do, and some wonderful families come out of it. But it's just not presented as something that happens anymore. So I do understand her reticence, but I hope that she does not feel embarrassed in any way or ashamed.
No, I don't think she does anymore. She had, you know, and I can relate to this, she had some Catholic guilt there for a long time.
Yeah, and of course,
you know, part of the story, too, involves just having to give up sort of your girlhood dreams. I mean, what girl doesn't dream of a big wedding, you know, nice and the elegant church wedding, and we all have our preconceived ideas, our dreams of what we want to happen, and then life suddenly hands you a
life
lemon.
Life does what it does. Yeah.
Yeah, and so you got to give all that up and realize maybe there's something higher to this, you know, you know, there's something higher going on here, and you know, that's part of it. A lot of it was her personal growth journey, her maturity, and her ability by reading authors like Stormy O'Martian, the Christian author, The Power of a Praying Wife, and even you know, John Gray, Mars Venus. And Dr. Laura Schlesinger, because, you know, here's another thing about our culture, Kia, and this relates to marriage and divorce. It's that people, you know, when the going gets tough, I think people just easily just want to leave. And, you know, Lori, I mean, her marriage, I mean, for the first couple of years, I mean, money was an absolute struggle, even after they had their second daughter. And she kept hanging in there and praying and praying and doing everything she could to support her husband, even when she didn't want to, even when she was really pissed off at him.
Yeah.
Now, again, I have to just, here's the caveat that we were dealing with two basically decent, good people. I mean, there was no abuse. I mean, nothing like that.
Well, he was very good, too. I mean, there was a very beautiful scene in that book where she tells her boyfriend that she's pregnant, and the first thing he does is drop to his knees and kiss her on the stomach. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, that's marriage material. She's very lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have turned out to be the kind of guy who was like, what? Get rid of it. You know, and then I don't really see a nice marriage coming out of that, but it could. But, you know, that might have been a knee-jerk reaction. But that the man did that right off the bat was really beautiful. That's a good man.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really, you know, and that reminds me of another tragedy in our culture is sort of like this assault on men, I think. In my opinion, a lot of these men, and I'm not making an excuse, but I think that they're so confused, they don't know how to behave. You know, if I hold a door for a woman, is she going to, like, say thank you and be gracious, or is she going to, like, freak out because I held a door for her because, oh, my God, maybe I think she doesn't know how to, you know, open a door for herself. I mean, I think we've gone so far to extremes here that basic courtesies that used to just be commonplace, you know, decades ago, like when my parents were dating, have just been almost completely lost, and it's very sad, and it's like,
It isn't just common courtesy. It's manliness in general has come under attack, and that's very
chivalry.
Frightening. It's chivalry and it's manliness. I mean, look what they've done to the National Football League. You know, they wear pink now. It's just terrible.
Yeah.
Come on. The you know, progressive culture is so very uncomfortable with manly men, and they try to eradicate the whole concept. And, you know, most of us women who like the manly men are not pleased with their efforts, and luckily there are plenty of manly men around who don't really pay any attention to that rubbish. But there's, as you say, definitely an assault on men, on their rights, on their manliness, on their gifts and charms, and it's terrible.
Yeah, it really is. It's awful. And, I think it's all by design, you know, because, again, if you have strong men, strong women, you know, if you have a self-reliant society, then that's sort of, that's the building block of a strong culture. And,
yeah.
You know, and that means government becomes irrelevant.
Yeah.
And the state can't step in and become small g gods for everyone, because you've got people who are able to stand on their own two feet, who know how to respect each other and love each other and deal with hardships without government interference.
And support each other. Yeah. And who don't want the government in there telling them how to raise their kids and stuff.
Yeah.
No, a lot of this is by design, and it's you know, a scary time in a lot of ways. So, again, if you don't already belong, sign up for the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook. Join us and spread the word about that, and let's do what we can to try to turn back some of the damage that's been done to our culture and our society.
Yeah, amen. So, Kia, your website is kiahebe.com, correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And where else can people find you?
Follow me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, at Kia Heavey, K-I-A-H-E-A-V-E-Y. I tweet, like, all different kind of bizarre things, so I don't know. Sometimes there's advice for writers. Sometimes there's comments on weather or whatever. I don't know. It's bizarre.
Awesome. Oh, I always enjoy your tweets. And, you know, and we also have a hashtag on there, too, a couple of different hashtags I want to put out there for people to follow. We have hashtag CLFA for Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance. Obviously, hashtag RightStream, and hashtag Confic, CONFIC, for Conservative Fiction.
Right.
And is there anything else I missed?
Conservative Fiction. Sorry?
Is there anything I missed?
No, those are the main ones, absolutely. And Conservative Fiction does include Libertarian Fiction as well. I do feel bad for a lot of Libertarians in our group, because they, if you shorten Libertarian, you get Lib, and we just cannot... you know, at copywriting, come up with a good way to include that in the Confic hashtag or anything. So that's why we have the CLFA, so that everyone is represented there. When you use the Confic tag, basically it's for personal freedom, personal responsibility literature.
Yeah, I tend to try to think of it as like constitutional conservative, because I think no matter what your opinions are on social issues, I think the one thing we all agree on is following the Constitution, you know, the states' rights. I mean, all these social issues could be solved if they were just given back to the states.
Yeah, and if you don't like the social rules in your state, you know, vote with your feet. Let's have 50 choices like we used to.
Right, exactly. And so that's the way to get around, to overcome that challenge of having the left try to drive us apart with social issues. It's just
we've got to not take the bait. They're going to do it, too, because they have, you know, Obamacare coming up in this next election is such a disaster, unmitigated disaster, and they've got no defense, so they're going to bring up social issues and try to divide us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we you know, and I would like to see, I think in this go around too, I'm all for candidates being pro-life, you know, and standing up for their values. I also believe at the same time they have to become more media savvy, and they've got to start learning how to anticipate these gotcha questions and answer them properly.
Oh, you know who was the best was Newt Gingrich. He would always throw the questions back in their faces. Like, I actually disagree with your entire premise. That's not true. It was the best. They couldn't do any of that to him.
Yes, stop playing on their turf. Start rejecting these premises. You know, with the issue of abortion, let me just say this because I know, Kia, we're running out of time. But, you know, when they start talking about rape, why can't somebody come back and say, because this is the God's honest truth. It's funny that you mentioned rape when that accounts for less than 1% of all abortions performed in this country. You know, like, start educating people.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, there's a way to deal with this, and I think we need more media-savvy people, or at least candidates who are willing to acknowledge what they need to learn and what they need to develop before they get out there on the campaign trail. That's something I would really love to see.
They're always going to get sacked by this mainstream media. They're always, no matter what you say, even if you say something perfect, they're going to twist it up and throw it at you. And no one's going to bother to listen to your original statement. That's just the way it works.
Well, which is also why I would just rather they stick to their principles and not be cowed by, oh, we can't win, you know, and we could go on and on about that, but that whole, you know, run to the center thing hasn't worked in decades.
No, it hasn't in years. It hasn't in years, yeah.
But won't. But Kia, oh my God, I loved our conversation. I can't believe the hour has gone by so quickly. Is there anything you want to say before we sign off here?
No, just I want to thank you so much for everything you do. You're amazing. You're very talented. Please keep doing the radio show, and whenever you can, you should guest on other people's shows to spread the word. You were on Hugh Hewitt's show, and you were a master. You're like a total wizard. You got the message out clearly and concisely. So I just want to say thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. And I'm just, like I said, it's been such a blessing to know you and Robert and all the CLFA friends, and just it's been, you know, there's also a certain level of comfort in knowing that you're not alone and that there are other people out there who feel the same way. And I think even just that alone is such a benefit.
Yeah, it's so good for morale. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, definitely. Well, Kia, please keep me posted as to when Underlake is going to be released, because I'll definitely blog about it and get a review
on
my blog. And oh, I can't wait.
I'll get you a copy as soon as it's out.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay,
well,
thank you
so
much for having me. All right.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was the wonderful Kia Heavey, independent author and graphic designer. Stay tuned here for just a few minutes. I have a few words to say. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back here in a few minutes.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern. Tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
And hello, everyone. We are back here with RightStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann. I just interviewed Kia Heavey, author and graphic designer. And I just wanted to take a couple of minutes here in the second hour. I'm not going to broadcast for a full hour, but I just wanted to mention a few things. First of all, shout out to all of our RightStream Radio Network hosts, John Gresham, Lisa Tarvis, Dr. Billy Eisenberg, Sheena Benjamin-Wise, and Kristen Fetterman. We have several shows broadcasting here on the network, and you can find out all about them at rightstreamradio.com. I actually started the network almost a year ago. It'll be a year on March 4th that we went live with Lisa's program, Just Believe, which, as you just heard, airs every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern. And we're going to be doing an anniversary show. I'm going to have a little roundtable with the other hosts coming up the first Tuesday in March, I believe. So please stay tuned for that. But I just want to thank my hosts for all of the time and effort and energy that they put into this. You know, none of us are really paid for what we do. We just do this kind of as a labor of love, and because we want to share good information with our listeners. So our lineup includes Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Military Monday with John D. Gresham, of course, RightStream Tuesday, Family Power Hour every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern with Dr. Billy Eisenberg and family law attorney Sheena Benjamin-Wise. That's basically a call-in format where listeners are encouraged to share their best practices and ask a question, if they have one, as to how to deal with sort of the slings and arrows of life, whether we're talking about marriage, divorce, relationships, parenting, you know, how to deal with just, you know, the things that life throws at us, all the difficulties that we all face. So that airs, Family Power Hour airs every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern on the network. Then back in November, we debuted Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss, hosted by Lisa Tarvez, her daughter Kristen Fetterman, and myself. And, you know, we originally launched that, and we started out with guests. And I think Lisa and I got talked about this. We're going to actually really sort of fine-tune the format of the show. We named it Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss for a reason. Love, of course, has anything to do with relationships. Liberty, you know, has to do with career and travel, good health, which, of course, gives you liberty. If you're healthy and doing well, you've got a lot of freedom. And lip gloss, meaning sort of like the fun things in life, you know, the trappings of life that make it enjoyable for women. I should say that obviously the show is geared for women's lifestyle, but lip gloss would include things like makeup and fashion and skincare and, you know, sort of the frillier side of life, I guess, or the, you know, the fun things in life. And so we are going to do I'm not going to call it a relaunch, but we're basically kind of changing the show. So this Friday night, we're going to each bring something to the table having to do with each of those categories. So we'll start out with love, and each of us will contribute something about love and liberty and lip gloss. And I think it'll be a lot of fun. You know, one of the challenges we've had since we have three hosts is when we bring on a guest, it's kind of difficult to avoid talking over each other and knowing when to give each other space and when to give the guest enough time to speak. So we're not eliminating guests altogether, but we're going to try to mix it up a little bit here and sort of make it like our own little panel. So I hope you'll tune in for Family Power Hour this Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, if you want to check out all of our archives here on Blog Talk Radio, it's just blogtalkradio.com/rightstream. So, you know, I encourage you, speaking of love, I have a contribution to make this week, and I'm not going to get into details, but, you know, I've had a very, very difficult, well, it's been a difficult year, but certainly the last couple of weeks have been pretty tough. And if you go to my blog, dariadigiovanni.com, you can kind of read my post about that. But I also wanted to mention, you know, I brought up Shirley Temple at the beginning of the show, and, wow, she was just my childhood idol, as I said. You know, I know that she was a child star during the Depression in the 30s, but, you know, she's really timeless. From what I've seen of people posting all over Facebook and Twitter, people of all ages are just talking about what an influence she was on their lives. I mean, I'm talking people from people in their 20s all the way up to people in their 80s. And I just wanted to read just briefly my little tribute to her. Because when I woke up this morning and saw my brother had posted that news on Facebook, it was really sad. I mean, just a really tragic way, I guess, to start the day. And I just want to send my condolences to her family. But I think because Shirley Temple was such a huge part of my childhood, I was really affected by this news this morning. You know, as a little girl, I just couldn't get enough of Shirley's sweet, wholesome movies. And I remember, you know, there was a local, back when we only had, you know, I don't know, three UHF stations and I don't know how many of the other kind of stations that there were, and I know I'm dating myself, but there was a local station every Sunday afternoon that used to play her movies, and I could not wait to come home from church and watch Shirley Temple movies, of course, when it wasn't football season, you know, because during football season we were watching football. But my mom at one point even found a record album, and those of you who are in my age group, I guess you remember those, my age group and older. She found a record album and bought it, and it was a gift for me of Shirley's greatest hits, and I played it over and over and over again, and really, I think my siblings and my family will remember that forever, because I drove them crazy. And my mom even managed, you know, after I begged and pleaded, she even managed to find me a Shirley Temple doll, like an original one from the 30s, because that previous summer we had gone to visit relatives in Connecticut, and my cousin Rita, who was an adult at the time, had this beautiful 3-foot-high Shirley Temple doll that I just immediately fell in love with. I mean, oh my God! I think if she would have been willing to part with that, that would have made my life. But my mom did her best to find one just as big, but was unable to, but she found me an adorable little Shirley Temple doll, and I remember it was one of my favorite Christmas gifts that year. And then I had a cousin who even gave me a special photo album filled with black and white stills of Shirley Temple posing in Cinderella frocks, which was that was the name of the company that manufactured all of her beautiful little dresses. And in fact, my own mother remembers being dressed up in Cinderella frocks as a little kid. My mom and Shirley are in the same sort of age range. And so, you know, Shirley Temple was one of those people who just successfully made the transition from childhood star to well-adjusted adult, and she just, her life just seemed to go on. I mean, she had a period where she made movies, and then she became an ambassador, and she had probably one of the fullest lives of any public figure I've ever known, and always had just a graciousness about her and a dignity, and will always be remembered with love. I mean, she was a class act all the way, so rest in peace, Shirley Temple, and just thank you for blessing us with your presence, because it was you've been a gift for so many people. So, all right, well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to end the show today. Got a lot of things to do on a deadline for Steps to Salvation, which is the name of the book that I'm ghostwriting. We are really on track to release it next month, and I've got a lot of work ahead of me if we're going to make that happen. But while I'm on that topic, please check out Shlomo Atiyah's blog at shlomoatiyah.wordpress.com. That's shlomoatiyah.wordpress.com. You can also like Shlomo Atiyah author on Facebook, and you can follow him at Shlomo Atiyah on Twitter. Not sure what's going on. Oh, tomorrow night on Family Power Hour, I believe they're having a jewelry giveaway for Valentine's Day, beautiful heart-shaped pendant on a chain. So definitely come back here at 7 p.m. tomorrow night for that. Join us for Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss Friday night at 7 p.m. And we'll start it all over again on Sunday with Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez at 7 p.m. Eastern. So once again, everyone, I want to thank you. You know, I just really appreciate you tuning in and listening to the show. It's been, like I said, it's been a tough week for me, but emotionally, but I'm really happy that I was, you know, we have to overcome, I think, without getting too deep, you know, life just doesn't stop. We have to keep going. And so hopefully you enjoyed our broadcast today, and hopefully you'll enjoy the book, Steps to Salvation, when I get that finished, because I really believe that there is a real purpose for me being the one selected to write this book, and I know it's going to have a huge impact on a lot of people for the better. So stay tuned, and if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Daria Ann. You can also follow WriteStream at WriteStream. You can find me on Facebook at Daria Ann Author. That's A-N-N-E. And where else? That's pretty much where I'm at. I'm also on Pinterest. And like Kia, I try to limit my social media platforms because I don't think you can do a lot of them effectively. I'd rather pick three or four and do them well than be spread out all over the place. So, and of course, you can always find me here on Blog Talk Radio. All right, everyone. Well, listen, have a great rest of the week, and I will see you back here for Write Stream Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern next Tuesday. God bless, and please stay in that flow of creativity. Keep rejoicing in that. Take care, everyone.